We're doing the Ramban on the Shoresh Hasheni, the second root, and the Ramban had been taking the Rambam to task because the Ramban understands that the Rambam means to say that things that are derived from the 13 laws of inference are rabbinic. And the Ramban says, no, the 13 laws of inference are very powerful. Sometimes what's derived from the 13 laws of inference is even biblical. So the Ramban, after enumerating numerous examples throughout the Talmud where the rabbis treated something derived from the 13 laws of derivation as biblical, the Ramban now continues, and we're up to page Kafchet in the standard editions, which is page Peichet in the Frankel editions, Vizeh Etzlam Torah Shlema. And this, by our sages, is a whole system. He calls it a Torah Shlema. Kmo Shamru, as they said, and before we read his proof, we need a backdrop to the scene, a little bit of introduction. So the Mishnah tells us in Gittin, it says, we have a testimony from Rabbi Yochanan ben Gudgida, that if you have a deaf girl whose father married her off, so then she gets divorced with a regular get. If you have a minor girl, you have a young girl who got married to a Kohen, she's allowed to eat truma, and if she passes away, her husband inherits her. And what we're interested in is, he quoted that if the public brought a public chata sacrifice, and they brought it unbeknownst to them, the animal was a stolen animal. So technically the public did not fulfill its obligations, because a stolen animal is disqualified from being a sacrifice. So the sacrifice nonetheless atones, because he uses the term mipnei takanata mizbeach, which the Gemara is now going to focus on. How does that work? If biblically it didn't work, so then how could the rabbis institute that it does work? If a stolen animal is disqualified from being a sacrifice, then how come the rabbis said it is? Amar Ula. So the Gemara begins with a quote from Ula, that technically, biblically, the animal is not a kosher sacrifice. Doesn't matter whether we found out about it or did not find out about it. It's a disqualified sacrifice. I'm reading from the Gemara now. So we have the backdrop to the Rambam. It says, technically, you have a stolen animal, disqualified. It can't work as a sacrifice. So then why is it that the rabbi said that if you ended up bringing it, it works? So as not to hurt the feelings of the Kohanim. That's the first line of the Gemara. The Kohanim ate from that meat. And if it turns out that that meat was disqualified, so then they transgressed. So the rabbi said, okay, it's kosher. So obviously that's a very difficult line. So the rabbis, the students said to Ula, what do you mean? The Mishnah says, mipnei tikun mizbeach. You're saying it's something to benefit the Kohanim. The Mishnah says it's because of something to do with the altar, tikun mizbeach. So he said to them, well, if the Kohanim get really upset, there'll be no one left to work. And then the Mizbeach is going to be left without its officers. So that's the idea here. So you'll ask me, says Rashi, how could the courts uproot a biblical law? If biblically the sacrifice is disqualified, that sacrifice was not a kosher chata sacrifice, so then you have to bring another one. So how do they do that? So we have a Gemara in Yevamos that tells us that the rabbis have power to tell us shev v'al taseh, meaning when it's an inaction, when they don't tell you to actively transgress a mitzvah, they just tell you shev v'al taseh, sit by and ignore it, that they're allowed to do. So that's a long piece in the Talmud in Yevamos, that the rabbis have that power to sometimes tell us b'shev v'al taseh. If they didn't tell me to actively do something, they could tell me to sit idly by and let things pass. Rav Yehuda said, no, biblically it works. So then why is it that the Mishnah says that if you didn't know about it, then we'll qualify it. But if you did know about it, then don't do it. Why? Because it's a rabbinic thing. The whole prohibition of using a stolen sacrifice is a rabbinic prohibition, because they don't want people to say, ah, the altar took stolen goods. So that's easier to swallow. If the whole problem is rabbinic, so then when we didn't find out about it, so it works. Yeah?
Can you explain that? I don't understand how to apply the Shabbat to
To this?
Yeah.
Because really, you have a kumase. Really, over here, you should get up and bring a different sacrifice. The rabbi said, sit down and don't. Uh-huh. That's Shevalta, I say.
But the Kohanim are still eating something that's disqualified. They're just like being told about it.
Right.
Isn't that a problem?
You're not doing anything. It's Shevalta, I say. Again, we're not saying anything.
Because saying something would upset the Kohanim?
Yeah. Well, upset the Kohanim and disrupt the whole service of the temple. So the rabbi said, just be quiet. If it happened, it happened. Don't get involved.
If you would say something, would they have to be, would the Kohanim have to bring some sort of kapara? Do some sort of kapara because they ate something that was disqualified?
I don't know. I guess that depends on the machlokas Ula and Rav Yehuda. But even then, I don't know if they have to bring it. I don't know. We're talking about a situation where it wasn't known. So I don't know if it means the owner didn't know. Meaning, you went and you bought an animal. You didn't know that it was stolen goods.
But before he offered it, you then found out that it was.
No, you found out after he offered it.
After
it was offered, they ate, the Kohanim ate. It's a done deal, and now we find out that was stolen goods.
Okay.
So then the question is, so the Mishnah says, we don't say anything. Keep quiet. It's done.
What kind of korban are we doing?
Chatas. So, the Talmud quotes, if someone stole and then dedicated the animal, and then he slaughtered the animal, so then he has to pay double, but not 4 and 5 times. And now, that's talking about a situation where he brought it into the temple and slaughtered it. What would happen if he would slaughter it outside the temple? So then he gets kares. Now, the Talmud questions, if technically he didn't own the animal, when you steal an animal, you have to own it first, right? If you don't own it, if I take your animal, and I don't own it yet, and I say, that animal is dedicated to the temple. If I don't yet own that animal, I can't dedicate your animal, right? So we have a rule that whenever you steal something, it's not yours until you do an action that makes a change in the object. You have to do an action of acquiring ownership. Now let's say the guy stole, and he did not yet do an action that makes it his. So then when he dedicated it, it wasn't dedicated to the temple. An animal that was dedicated as a sacrifice, if you slaughter it outside the temple, so then there's a punishment of kares, getting cut off. This guy stole it. It didn't yet become his. He dedicated it. So it seems he couldn't dedicate it, right? Because it's not yet his. Yet the Braisa says, if he would slaughter it outside the temple, then we treat it as though it were a fully dedicated animal that was slaughtered outside the temple, and he gets kares. So the Gemara questions, wait a second. What are you punishing him for? He couldn't dedicate it. When he slaughtered it outside the temple, you can't treat it as though it was a dedicated animal slaughtered outside the temple. It wasn't yet his. If I take someone's object and I didn't do anything to it, I take your iPhone, I put it in my pocket. It's not mine. It's yours. It's your iPhone in my pocket, right? I take your animal and I dedicate it to the temple. I didn't do anything yet. So it's not yet dedicated to the temple. I have no right to dedicate your animal. Now I take it and I slaughter it outside the temple. So do I view it as I slaughtered your animal outside the temple, or I slaughtered the temple's animal outside the temple? I had no right to dedicate it, so it's still your animal. So the Gemara questions, how come he's punishable with kares? As though he had slaughtered the temple's animal, realistically it's your animal he slaughtered outside the temple. You with me so far? Okay, so on that, Rav Shizvi answers, well, it's a rabbinic kares. Now, kares is a punishment in the Torah. So everyone laughed at him. Where do you have a rabbinic kares? And this is where our Ramban comes in. You have a situation where the guy stole an animal. It's not yet his. He dedicated it. The dedication isn't valid. He slaughters it. We treat it as though the dedication was valid, and he's punishable with kares. The rabbis ask, how could you give him kares? It's not his. It wasn't legally dedicated. They say it's a rabbinic kares. So everyone laughed. How could you have a rabbinic kares? Rava said, if a big rabbi told you something, don't go laughing. What it means is, karet she'al yedei tivrehem ba'atalo. This is a biblical kares that came to be through a rabbinical ruling. When he said it's a rabbinical kares, he also knew the rabbis can't institute a punishment by heaven. The Torah says if a person gets kares or not, the rabbis can't give him, they can't say it's punishable with kares. Ukmu ha-rabanan birshutei. The rabbis say, if you stole an animal and you dedicate it to the temple, so we just said it's not your animal to dedicate. Along come the rabbis and say, it's yours. And if you dedicate it, it's not really yours, you're a thief. But if you dedicate it, we let the dedication settle on the animal. And then if you slaughter it outside the temple, so then the person gets kares. So how could the rabbis do that? We have a rule, hefker bezdin hefker. The courts have a right to take your money. They have monetary rights. They can't do it at whim, but if the courts choose to, they can. So then the courts say, it's your animal, I stole it. It's not yet mine, I dedicate it. It shouldn't be dedicatable. I can't, it's not mine. What do the rabbis say? Fine, we have monetary power, we hereby make this animal mine. The rabbis say, they make it mine. It was yours, I stole it, I didn't do an action that made it mine. But the rabbi said it's mine. Now I dedicate that animal. If I slaughter, my dedication is valid in that sense, because the rabbis made it monetarily mine. So the rabbis can affect ownership, which then affects the biblical punishment of kares. That's what he meant, a rabbinic kares. The rabbis can't give you kares. The rabbis affected ownership, which made him chai of kares. You with me?
You're saying that when they made it hefker, he therefore acquired it.
Right.
Stealing.
Right.
This was done retroactively.
It's a good question. If we were learning then, we'd have to look it up.
Does this encourage stealing?
No. This is to punish the thief. Meaning so that if the thief were to then say, think about it. I steal your animal. I want to be very pious. You know, those people, there are a lot of thieves. There's a guy who does a Ponzi scheme and he dedicates $100,000 to YU. Now he feels pious. Now, technically, we say it's not your money to give. So the Torah has punishments, and the rabbis also did things to punish him more. So one of the things they did was that if let's say after he pledges on the Yom Kippur fund, he pledges, Mafter Yonah, I'll give $1 million to the shul. So the rabbis say, okay, now you're responsible for that. Meaning when he dedicated the animal, and then he takes it home and slaughters it and eats it, he dedicated it in public. He came to shul and said, I'm going to go up to Jerusalem and this animal is hereby dedicated. The shul doesn't know it's your animal. This thief stands there and says, I'm going to bring it. He goes home a day later, slaughters it, and eats it. Along come the rabbis and say, you think you're going to get away with it. Retroactively, we're going to make that your animal. We have the monetary power to make it yours. When you dedicate it to the temple, it was valid. When you eat it, you're chayiv kare. So then the rabbis do him in. Biblically, he's done in because the rabbis have the power to make it his. So that's what he meant when he said it's rabbinic kares. Correct. Correct.
And it's like Torah. It's like... Because the rabbis have that power from Doraita.
So that's the Ramban. Very good. So now, because he slaughtered it outside the temple, he dedicated it. The Gemara then asks, at what point do the rabbis make it his? When he stole it or when he dedicated it? Meaning, what would be the difference if he gave birth to a child before he slaughtered it? Is it his child or the other ones? If you made it his earlier on, so then it's his. When he gave birth, the baby's his. You know, if he's caught later, so the Talmud says, obviously the rabbis wouldn't do it to benefit him anything. It only becomes his a second beforehand. Okay, so now, what?
They can't make it his after he's already killed, though, so it has to be declared his right before.
again.
At what point, like, when they transfer the ownership, at what point, like, they can't transfer it once it's already been killed?
Right. They transfer the ownership the second before he dedicates it.
But don't they have to make, like, a verbal declaration? No.
They make an institution and it becomes valid. So now let's read the Ramban again. So this whole institution, that the rabbis can make it his, so that he gets kares, stems from which strength? Their strength to change legal ownership. Their strength to affect our monetary rights. That strength affects the biblical punishment of kares. Says the Ramban, I just told you earlier that the courts have a right to take ownership, and that stems from where? From a pasuk in prophets. That's what you just asked. Hey, does it say it anywhere in the Torah? It doesn't say it anywhere in the Torah. It's derived from the prophets. So you could have a derivation which has biblical implications. Maimonides said all derivations are rabbinic. Says the Ramban, no. The whole concept that the courts have a right to change ownership stems from a derivation of a pasuk in prophets. V'zeh etznam Torah Shneimah. And the rabbis view this idea that they could change legal ownership as a whole system, as a whole Torah. It's biblical. They don't say it's rabbinic. Kmo shamru, as we find the Talmud says, karet midivrayim miika. Is there any such concept that you'll give him kares rabbinically? Ve'eshivu, so the Talmud answers, karet she'al divrayim batlo. It's not a rabbinic kares. But how did he become chay of kares, this thief? Because the rabbis took their rabbinic power, made it his, then the dedication is valid, then when he slaughters it outside the temple, he's chayv kares. Ukmu rabbanan birshutei, the rabbis made the animals his, ki heichidil chayv alei, so that he will be chayv kares for having slaughtered it outside the temple. So the Ramban says, you see, here you have a derivation, and the derivation is so powerful that it has biblical consequences, to the point of giving a guy kares. But he says the Rabbanan is the rabbinic power, but the rabbinic power has biblical implications. Yeah. So then the derivation has to be biblical to give the rabbis the power to take something away from someone.
So now we're looking for where that is stated in the.
He said that earlier. We learned that last time where it's stated, and he's just saying here's another proof against Maimonides. You see that something that was derived, even derived from the prophets, has biblical weight because you see it impacts the laws of the Torah biblically. The rabbinic power that was derived has biblical weight. Maimonides says any derivation is rabbinic.
Right.
Nachmanides says no. Here's one more example where it's biblical. In 1 minute, the Ramban will address that in 1 minute.
What do you mean it's biblical?
If it affects the kares, kares is biblical.
Okay.
It affects kares. Uvarishon shel chulinin, in the first chapter of Tractate Chulin, Amar Rav Chista. Rav Chista says, minayin lebdikat sakin min haTorah. We have a halacha in Shechita that when you slaughter an animal, you have to check the knife. So there are a few halachos in that. First of all, you check that there's no bumps in the knife. There's no place that there's any break in the knife. It's as smooth as you go up and down with your nail, and you see that it's completely smooth. There's another halacha that says you take that knife and you show it to the chacham, to the rabbi of the city. Okay? So initially, the Talmud understood that what Rav Chista was asking is, where in the Torah does it say you should check the knife that it's completely smooth before you slaughter with it? Shenemar, as the verse says, Ushchatem bazem, v'achaltem, you slaughter with this and eat. So the Talmud asks, wait a second, what do you need a derivation from a verse? V'ikshu, the Talmud asks, Pshita dekevan dechinak v'atrefa v'ayabdika. We have another law. We have certain things that make an animal a trefa. If when you slaughter the animal, you don't slaughter in the neck. You hack it from the back down. It's not a kosher animal, it's a trefa. If when you slaughter the animal, instead of slicing the trachea, the kane and the veshet, the what are they called in English? Kane and veshet, what he breathes and swallows through. The windpipe and the food pipe. Okay. So instead of slicing it, if he were to take pliers and pull it out, so it's a trefa, it's not kosher. The halacha says any time you pierce it, but you don't slice it, the animal is a trefa. Now, if the knife has a little crack in it. When that crack touches the windpipe or the food pipe, it tears it. It doesn't slice it. So the Talmud says, what do I need a derivation from a verse for? I know that if the windpipe or the food pipe was torn instead of sliced, then it's not a kosher animal. It's not kosher shechita. It's not kosher meat. So obviously I have to check the knife to make sure it won't tear. What do you need a special pasuk to tell you check the knife? If I know the halacha is that if you tore the windpipe or the food pipe, then it's a treifa, then obviously you have to check that you shouldn't tear it, that you'll slice it.
Why do you have to check? You just do it and then hope for the best.
Fine, okay, and you'll check later. Whatever, right. The Shivu, so the Gemara answers, when we said, what's the source that you have to check a knife, we didn't mean to check that it's smooth. You're right. That's obvious that you have to check that the knife is smooth, because otherwise it's not kosher shechita if it's not smooth. Lechacham kamrinan. What we meant is that what's the source that you have to show the chacham, the rabbi of the town, the knife before you use it. So the you see that he said to them, Mushchatem bazeh. He was showing them, this is the knife you guys shecht with. So you see, they brought it to the rabbi, and he told them, you check it. V'chakru, so the Gemara asks, wait a second, l'chacham, we're talking about showing it to the rabbi. V'amar Rav Yochanan lo amru la'arot sakin l'chacham ele mipnei kvodo shel chacham. Rav Yochanan said, there's no real halacha that you have to show the knife to the rabbi. The whole idea was the rabbis wanted to ensure that kashrus is something that's taken seriously. So slaughtering meat requires a certain level of being a God-fearing person, because no one's going to know after you cut up the meat what's happening. You know, you write a parsha, if you're a sofer stam, everyone sees what you did afterwards. You do bris mila, everyone sees what you did afterwards. You slaughter an animal, you cut it up to pieces, no one knows what you did afterwards. No one knows, kosher, not kosher, they're not going to know. So the rabbis knew that when it comes to shechita, they need a certain amount of responsibility by the leader of the town, because the shochet has to know that he's under his jurisdiction, because his job involves being a Yirei Shamayim, being a God-fearing person. So the rabbis made an institution. You, the shochet, may not shecht before you show your knife to the rabbi. It's a way of reminding the shochet you're under his jurisdiction. It's like they used to have this practice that the knight would have to receive his arms from the king. Or the queen, you guys know that? Yeah, he gives him his arms. He's like, what? I don't know. It's quoted in Jonah. I don't know exactly how they used to do it, but it was a way of showing, my arms come from you. I think they do that in the army today too. That the general gives him his gun, right? There's this whole procession where he gets his gun from a top commander. Like, here too. The shochet has to get his knife approved by the rabbi of the town, and that's a rabbinic institution to remind the shochet that he's under his jurisdiction. Yeah, on some level. So then the Talmud says, you're right. Elamid Rabbanan. Really, the whole idea of showing the knife is rabbinic. The kras machta be'alma. And the verse is just an asmachta. It's something, it's an allusion to the concept, but it's not a derivation. V'ninman mizeh. Now what you see here, they quoted the pasuk Ushchatem Bazeh. That's a pasuk in Nevi'im, in the prophets. It's not a pasuk in the Torah. Ushchatem Bazeh V'achaltem. King Saul said to the people, here's what you slaughter with and eat. So it's a pasuk in prophets. Initially the Talmud entertained the thought that we're going to learn a biblical law from a pasuk in prophets. Says Nachmanides, how's that? According to the Rambam, how do you do that? So the Ramban says, you see here, that they treat the verses and prophets as Torah. And you could derive from them, velomdim mem, and learn from them, vosim mem gam ken asmachtot. So if you, in this case, they didn't learn from it, they made an asmachta from it. Vekvar amru, and here's the Gemara that Amichai was quoting. The Talmud says in Megillah, 48 nevi'im v'sheva nevi'ot amdu lehem ni'israel. You had 48 prophets and 7 female prophets. Lo pichtu v'lo otiru al mashkatuv b'Torah filu ot achat. They didn't add or detract from the Torah even one letter. Chutz memikah Megillah. The only exception is that the rabbis instituted reading the Megillah on Purim. May darush, how did they derive you should read the Megillah on Purim? Amar chia baravin mishum Rabbi Yehoshua ben Kocha, kal vachomer. Their derivation was a fortiori, one of the 13 laws of derivation. Umam avdut lecherot amru shira. If we sang a song, if we sang praise, when we left Egypt. And in Egypt, they weren't killing us, they were just enslaving us. And yet they sang a song, the Torah tells us they sang, Memavet Lechaim Lo Kol Sheken. Don't we say you certainly should sing when you're saved from death? There was the decree to annihilate the Jewish people, God forbid, and it was absolved. So obviously you have to read the Megillah as a song of praise to God for saving us. So here, Limdu otanu bezeh, ki kol ha-takanot va-gzirot, einan tosefet, aval hem geder v'siag la-Torah. The Talmud over here was teaching us that all the institutions, be it a takana or a gzera, that the rabbis derived from the verses of the prophets, are nothing new. They're just a protection for the Torah. Aval mikra megillah hi tosefet. But reading the Megillah, that's called adding to the Torah. Lefi shenichtiva ba-Torah v'ukva chova le-dorot. Why is that an addition? Because it's a part of the Torah, and it's a set institution for generations. So how do you make a set institution for generations? Ela shesamchu al chiyuvah b'kal v'chomer hazeh, v'aktivatah min harem shematzuk tov zot zikron b'sefer. They had a source for writing it, and they had a source, the sportiori, for obligating it.
So it's kal v'chomer, the taking of the Exodus, and then saying that we have to sing the...
Yeah, so we can expand that for a second. There's a Chassam Sofer on that, which I like to quote. Chassam Sofer says, this is Doraisa. We just learned the derivation from the Torah. That means that so the Chassam Sofer asks, does that mean that reading the Megillah on Purim is biblical? We just learned the Kal V'chomer from the Torah. So the Chassam Sofer says no, because the Kal V'chomer doesn't tell you you should read the Megillah. The Kal V'chomer says, if it was celebrated by singing a song when you left Egypt and there was no danger to life, then there should be a level of celebration when your lives were saved, when the Jewish people's lives were saved. So, according to that Kal V'chomer, the Chassam Sofer says, there's a biblical prohibition to fast on Purim, because he says that would be going against the Kal V'chomer. Whether you actually have to read the Megillah, give Mishloach Monos, how you'll actually celebrate it, okay, that's already rabbinic. So then I say, okay, so then let's take a step further. If there was a danger of annihilation for the Jewish people, and then they were saved, so how could you fast on that day? So you could say that on Yom HaTzimut, there wasn't a danger for all of the Jewish people. Some of the people were in the United States. Some of the people were elsewhere. But there's definitely a basis for thinking for a minute, hey, wait a second, something big happened here. And room to question whether you'd be allowed to fast on that day. You guys with me?
One question. Wouldn't that mean that not reading the Megillah Dafka would be biblical, but doing something would be biblical? I mean,
maybe.
It doesn't have to be the Megillah, but if you do something, then wouldn't that be considered biblical?
Maybe. I hear. I agree. There's room to discuss this. Yeah.
Singing a song, jumping or something like that.
So that's the question, right? How far do we take this? Meaning, where do the rabbis' role in defining what the Jewish people should do, where does it carry biblical weight? But the Chassam Sofer seems to say no, that the Mikra Megillah is not biblical, but not fasting, that's biblical.
Is there something else from Doraita that they can take that it's necessary to read the Megillah?
Well, they have another source for the idea of adding a book to Tanakh. That, the Gemara says, they needed a source for that too. To actually record this is something that everyone's going to read, recording the Megillah. Yeah?
So I just want to confirm, did I hear you say that the only thing that they instituted was the Megillah?
We said every other institution was a protector of the Torah, but we have to hear the Ramban's next sentence. Okay. Meaning he began by saying, everything you encounter is either takana or gzeira. Just the reading of the Megillah is considered an addition to the Torah, and we caught him mid-sentence. He's about to say something else. He told us earlier, he just showed us a whole list of things we saw a few weeks ago that the prophets tell us do or don't do. So he says, yes, when the prophets tell you don't do, and the Ramban had shown us that sometimes that carries biblical weight, really, that prohibition was a tradition. Like we said numerous times, the rabbis had a tradition of how you have to mourn. The rabbis had a tradition of what Kohanim had to do. There are certain laws of Kohanim that are derived from Ezekiel. There are certain laws of mourning that are derived from Yechezkel. The Talmud asks, before Yechezkel came along, this mitzvah didn't exist. The Talmud says, sure, it existed. They had a tradition, and then the prophets gave it a verse. But really, the halacha existed from the days of Moshe. And we've discussed numerous times that that's what the Machzor Vitri writes in his introduction to Pirkei Avos. Rabbi Rashi had a disciple, Rabbi Simcha, of the city Vitri. And he wrote a siddur called the Machzor Vitri, which encompasses many customs and traditions that we have. So one of the things he writes there is, why do we call the words of the prophets Divrei Kabbalah? He says, because the prophets really didn't tell us anything new. They just put into writing things that we had originally on tradition. Any concept you see in the prophets that you don't see in the Torah, you should know existed. It existed in traditional form, and the prophet gave it a written verse. Sometimes we derive things from the prophets, and this quantifies what we learned earlier in the Ramban. The Ramban spent a few paragraphs showing how we have biblical mitzvos that are based in verses and prophets. Now the Ramban is saying, like the Machzor Vitri said, it's not that the prophets could tell you something biblical, but rather the tradition was that this is it, and then the prophets gave it a verse. There's room to explore what the Kuzri holds on this. The Kuzri has a piece on this too, in the end of his third Ma'amal. But okay, right now we're learning Ramban. Yeah.
So is it saying that like what the prophets are putting in the verses is like except from Torah Shebal Peh?
Correct. Until then it was Torah Shebal Peh. Okay. Torah Shebal Peh.
I thought that we didn't write that. I thought that was like a big thing because you're going to see this right now.
I guess a prophet could. It's a good question. It's a good question. Ata Yechezkel ve'asmechei akro. And you're saying dvarim shebal peh. We have to look closely in the Machzor Vitri. I have a thought of an answer, which I think we could see if we look closely at the words of the Machzor Vitri, but I don't want to say it because it's a big chiddush if he doesn't say it, which I wouldn't say. So we have to look it up again. It's a very good question. We have to look. Remember, the Gemara didn't say it's Adin Drabanan. The Gemara says Gemara Gemirila. They were taught it from Sinai. They knew it from Sinai. So there's room to discuss if what they knew from Sinai necessarily had the weight of Torah Shebal Peh. Meaning I answered you off the cuff Torah Shebal Peh as a general. Yes, it was Baal Peh. But there's room to explore this a little bit with more accuracy. Whether Gemara Gemirila means it was Torah Shebal Peh in the sense that it had the halacha of Dvarim Shebal Peh Yatar Hashai LeKotvan. We have to check.